Omaniti Namane, Namaste, Sarasakti Devi, Gaudavani Pacharanini Vishesha, Sunyavari Pascharcha Devi, Sarane, Mangyanam Timurandasya, Garanjana Shirakaya, Chaksuri, Miritam Jainam Tasmai, Sri Gurave Namaha, Panchakalpa, Trutyas Chakri, Pasindu, Beva, Chapatita, Nam, Havane, Yo, Vaishnave, Yo, Namaha. So this evening, we will look at some of chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita. Instead of just talking about one verse, we'll take an overview of a whole section of the Bhagavad Gita and try all to see these verses together. In the second chapter, Krishna teaches two things. One is called Sankhya Yoga, and the other is called Buddhi Yoga. Now really, they're just two aspects of the same thing, and both of them are ways of looking at Bhakti Yoga. But nevertheless, first he talks about what he calls Sankhya. The word Sankhya in Sanskrit means to count, or to analyze. In the part on Sankhya Yoga, Krishna teaches Arjuna the difference between the self and the not-self, the soul and the material body, and how the soul, the self, is unchanging and eternal and undying, whereas the body is the opposite of all those things. And one distinguishes between the self and the not-self. This is important to know because it's the beginning of the answer as to why we are suffering in this world, because we do not know who we are. We have identified ourselves falsely with this material body and this material mind, whereas really we are transcendentally situated spirit soul. We are here in the body in the sense that our consciousness pervades the whole body, but we are actually not the body. We suffer, however, in this world because we have our consciousness has become contaminated and we identify ourselves with the body. That's the first part. However, if I just understand or know or am convinced through philosophical argument that I'm not the body, that by itself does not take me out of the bodily conception of life. I'm a Hare Krishna. I know I'm not my body. I believe this. Nevertheless, I can go on experiencing myself because I'm involved in the body, because I am depending upon the body for my happiness, that the happiness and distress that comes to the body I experience is happening to me. So, therefore, although I may know I'm not my body, this is theory. Now it needs to be put into practice. So the theory, you might say, is Sankhya Yoga, and the practice is Buddhi Yoga. So, Buddhi Yoga means it applies to this intelligence. This is the Sanskrit word Buddhi. This is not to be confused with what in the West we may think of as intelligence. Because in Sankhya, the body is first of all the gross body, earth, water, fire, air, ether. This is described in more detail in the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And then there's the subtle body. In Sanskrit, this is shukshma sharira. And this is made up of three elements: manas, buddhi, and ahankara. Manas being the mind, buddhi being intelligence, and then there is my wrong idea about myself, my false ego. The false ego is what causes me to identify the self with the body. Intelligence is higher than the mind, buddhi. It is not the mind. The mind simply thinks and feels and wills, accepting and rejecting in terms of sense gratification. Buddhi is higher than the mind, and it controls the mind. When in the process of yoga, which is about controlling the mind and the senses, the actual agent that controls is buddhi. Otherwise, the mind is very, it's described as impulsive, flickering, unstable, accepting anything that comes that I taste. I taste something, my mind, if it tastes good, it accepts it. If it tastes bad, it rejects it. That's all. Immediately accepting and rejecting on the basis of sense gratification. Now, if we lived just like that, well, we would be like a little baby. We'd just be like a child. Because a child with intelligence is undeveloped. And they're purely mental. They would never grow up except they acquire intelligence. That to control the mind and to control the senses. That intelligence actually first comes from the outside, from the parents. Don't do this, do this, don't do this, don't do this. And then after it sinks in, then the intelligence becomes formed like this. So otherwise, if there's no intelligence, we couldn't even walk across a room. You couldn't engage in any long-term activity. You'd just be distracted by your mind all the time. So buddhi yoga is about intelligence. And especially using the intelligence to control the mind and control the senses. Because when we do that, then we can start to actually have some realized knowledge, experiential knowledge, that I am a spirit soul and that I am not the body. So this is what's being taught now, this buddhi yoga, in the second chapter. One thing is that this path of buddhi yoga as a spiritual path, one thing that Krishna says it requires is a single-minded purpose, fixed intelligence. Vyavasa atmika buddhi means you have one aim. You don't have many things you're trying to do, but you try to do this one thing. Then you'll become successful. That means in Krishna conscious terms, Krishna consciousness cannot be one thing among many in my life. If it is, I will fail. That doesn't mean I don't do other things, but somehow or other, whatever else I do is included in that single-minded purpose. And in fact, we learn how to do that in Krishna consciousness. Even the material activities, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, we learn how to do in such a way that they serve this single purpose. This is called Vyavasa Atmika Bhuti. Now in explaining this, he says to Arjuna says Krishna says to Arjuna that this means this act is a way of buddhi yoga is a way of acting, performing your karma, your in this case your prescribed duties, the things you're supposed to do, in this case prescribed by the Vedas, You have a right to perform your prescribed duties, but you are not entitled to the fruits of action. In other words, you have a right to your duty, but not to the result. Never consider yourself the cause of the result of your activities, and never be attached to not doing your duty. So he's beginning to describe a certain state of mind, where I do what I'm supposed to do, and with detachment to success or failure, I am simply just do the duty itself. I don't worry about whether how it will come out, because I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, and I'm also not doing my duty because I'm lazy or afraid or anything like that. So he says to Arjuna, you should perform your duty equipoise, that is, with an even mind, and not attached to success or failure. And in this case, he's a warrior on a battlefield. It's very hard for a warrior in a battlefield not to be attached to success or failure, but he says that's what we should do. And he calls this Buddha Yoga the art of work, the art of all work. So after describing this, which I've summarized here, a little more complete here, we come to text 54. And I want to discuss 54 to the end of this chapter. Because then Arjuna asks questions. He asks about this person who acts like this. He calls him a sthita D. Later on, sthita D Muni. D, D-H-I-T, is another word for intelligence. And sthita means fixed. Here you're just fixed on doing what you're supposed to do, and you're not distracted by anything. Your aim is there. Ultimately, serving Krishna, and you don't, not attached to success or failure, not distracted by other things. So now there's the questions about this person, the sthita D Muni, the sage of steady mind, or steady intelligence. Also called sthita prajna. Prajna is another word for intelligence. So Arjuna asked Krishna four questions. What are the symptoms of one whose consciousness is thus merged into transcendence? How is this person, how would you describe him? First question, what are his symptoms? How is he talked about? How does he speak? What is his language? How does he sit? And how does he walk? These are the questions. And so now, Krishna answers these questions. It's clear that what you get in this part of the Bhagavad Gita is a kind of a description of an ideal person, a hero, somebody Arjuna is attracted to. He wants to know more because this kind of person, what would it be like? How would I recognize him? You're talking about something extraordinary. So we get the whole description. So he asks the symptoms, these characteristics that you would describe. And then we said, so there are four questions. How this person speaks, how he sits, and how he walks. So they're really answered. Now, the symptoms, the first question, what are his symptoms or how is he described? This is answered in the next text, where there's a general description of this sthita D Muni, or the sthita prajna Muni. So this is the general description, answered the first question. When a person gives up all varieties of desire for sense gratification, which arise from mental concoction, you see there's the mind, right? Looking for creating desires. And when his mind thus purified finds satisfaction in the self alone, then he is said to be in pure transcendental consciousness. The sthita prajna. So that's the general description. Giving up all varieties of desire for sense gratification, and when the purified mind now finds satisfaction in the self, that is in the spirit soul and in the super spirit, the pure state of the soul, then this is the nature of this person. Next, the next question was, how does he speak? Now, in commenting on the Bhagavad Gita, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says that the question, how does he speak, means that how does he respond to others by his speech and by his intelligence? What is his response? So now two verses describe his response. One who is not disturbed in mind, even in the midst of threefold miseries. So here you see the first thing, the threefold miseries. You know what the threefold miseries are? Those which are caused by your own body and mind, those which are caused by other living entities. So your own body and mind, nothing's bothering you, but your head hurts and your mind is flipping out. you cause so many troubles, your body and mind. Those caused by other living entities, terrorists and people like that, we're all afraid of. And then those caused by adidaivika, those caused by the gods, like tsunamis and earthquakes and things like that. Those are threefold miseries. Huh? So one who's not disturbed even amidst the threefold miseries, or elated when there is happiness. So when bad things happen, not downcast or disturbed, still the same. And when good things happen, you win the lottery or something, you know, you're still jumping up and down and screaming. Who's free from attachment, fear, and anger is called a sage of steady mind. And then he says, in the material world, one who is unaffected by whatever good or evil he may obtain, neither praising it, this is where the speech thing comes in, neither praising it nor despising it, is firmly fixed in perfect knowledge. So good and evil come from the material nature, good things and bad things. And when one is fixed in transcendence, this is the characteristic. Simply equipoise, doesn't praise it, doesn't despise it. So this is, how does he speak? People all over the world, you know, a lot of times, if you listen to the voice of humanity, they're either doing this, complaining, and something good happens, they're talking about that, telling all their friends, go to this restaurant, eat this, take this, buy this, enjoy this, you're like this. This is horrible. This is terrible. The whole thing is like that. So the sage of steady mind. How can one be like this? Because one's source of happiness does not depend upon the course of the material world. There is a source of happiness, naturally. But this is on the spiritual platform. So no matter what happens, good or bad, actually one is unaffected. The next part, how does he sit? Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says this really indicates how does such a sage not engage his senses. when he's also still. Sometimes he's active, sometimes not active. How does he not engage his senses? So this is 58 and 59 answer this question. How does he sit? One who is able to withdraw his senses from the sense objects, as the tortoise draws its limbs within the shell, is firmly fixed in perfect consciousness. So whenever necessary, you can do it. The senses are all going out attracted to the objects, but you can pull them in. So the example of the turtle or the tortoise is very nice. You know, the four legs are sticking out, and also the tail and the head, and they all go inside, slam shut. So like that. When necessary, whenever it needed to do this, you can do it. And then he explains this verse, which we are very fond of. The embodied soul may be restricted from sense enjoyment, though the taste for sense objects remains. Because you're thinking, how can I do this? How can I pull my senses in? And here Krishna is saying, this is really not quite enough. You can pull your senses in, but inside the taste is still there. So they'll come back sometimes of their own accord, like that. So what to do about that? But ceasing such engagements by experiencing a higher taste, he's fixed in consciousness. Param drishtva. He has experienced something higher, something beyond the material world, and therefore is fixed. Now, the next four texts are kind of a digression, an aside. One thing that, because having described this withdrawal of the senses from the object, Krishna is reminded that Arjuna wanted to quit the battlefield and go off to the forest by himself and meditate. And just, you know, shut everything out. And Krishna doesn't advise this path for Arjuna. And now he says, now he describes the difficulty. He says, the senses are so strong and impetuous. You know, impetuous, it acts suddenly like on impulse. Go here, go there, do this, do that. This is impetuous. The senses are so strong and impetuous that they forcibly carry away the mind even of a man of discrimination who's endeavoring to control them. Also, we know this problem. They go away. They act on their own sometimes. One who restrains his senses, keeping them under full control, and fixes his consciousness upon me, is a man of steady intelligence. This is where Krishna explicitly says, what is this param you're supposed to be thinking of? Matparaha. He focuses his intelligence on me. He's the man of steady intelligence. So that's how you can actually restrain your senses. But otherwise, now he describes, while contemplating the objects of the senses, a person develops attachment for them. And from such attachment, lust develops. And from lust, anger arises. So here's now a sequence. The senses are there. We contemplate them in the mind. We remember the objects of the senses and contemplate them in the mind. And thinking about it, we develop attachment. That really tasted good. I'd like to taste that again. I wonder how I can, and so on. We become attached. Then from this attachment, this desire to enjoy, kama, lust, the desire to enjoy arises. And then from there, anger. Why anger? Because I become frustrated. The famous song by Mick Jagger, "You can't always get what you want." The human condition. the more you want, the more you suffer, because and then you become frustrated and disappointed, and you become more and more angry. Most people are going around in the world in states of anger, especially if you consider that depression is a form of anger. And they say that's what it is. It's anger directed inside is depression. So then he keeps going. From anger, complete delusion arises. Sammohan, you're totally bewildered. And from delusion, bewilderment of memory. You lose your memory. That is to say, your ability to remember Krishna or to recollect who you are, the memory becomes bewildered. And then intelligence is lost, buddhi. The very thing you need to keep on the path, this intelligence is destroyed. And when intelligence is lost, one falls down again into the material pool. Well, there's a whole path of bang, 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 all the way down. Prabhupada used the word bloop. He said the sound the soul makes when he falls into the material energy is bloop. It's the falling into the material pool. No, that's what happens. So now we go back, and now the last question: how does he walk? And now we're at text 64, and this goes almost to the end of the chapter. How does he walk? Means how does he engage his senses? Walking being one of the active senses. So how does he engage his senses? How does he move around in the world? So he says, but a person free from all attachment and aversion. So attachment means you want things in the material world, and aversion means you go away. Desire and hate, attachment and aversion. So you have to be free from both. These are called the dualities. The Dwanda Mohina. Later on in the Bhagavad Gita, one is bewildered by these dualities of desire and hate, attachment and aversion. A person free from all attachment and aversion and able to control his senses through the regulative principles of freedom can obtain the complete mercy of the Lord. It attains prasadam. That's what it says here. Mercy. Nice phrase here, huh? The regulative principles of freedom. People will think this is a contradiction. But by regulating and controlling the senses, one actually becomes free. We think of freedom of letting my senses do whatever they want, but then you just get dragged around. You're in bondage. So he goes on, for one thus satisfied, the threefold miseries of material existence exist no longer. In such satisfied consciousness, one's intelligence, again buddhi, one's buddhi, is soon well established. One who is not connected with the Supreme, let's say in Krishna consciousness or Buddha yoga, can have neither transcendental intelligence nor a steady mind. Without which there is no possibility of peace. And how can there be any happiness without peace? This word peace here, shanti, it's a famous word in Hinduism, huh? Shantihi, 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 these Upanishads. So what it means is peace from the pangs or the sufferings of material existence. There is no peace in the material world. So this is that transcendent peace. In the Christian text, there's referred to the peace that passes all understanding. That is that peace that's there no matter what else is going on around you. You are still at peace. So Krishna continues, as a strong wind sweeps away a boat on the water, even one of the roaming senses on which the mind focuses can carry away a man's intelligence. Well, that's a nice description. A boat's on the water, the wind comes, the boat just goes off course. So any sense focuses on any object, it can draw the mind and then take the intelligence with it. You lose control. The senses pulls the mind and the mind pulls the intelligence. It should be the other way around. Therefore, O mighty armed, one whose senses are restrained from their objects is certainly of steady intelligence. And then he gives a very interesting verse. This one's wonderful verse. What is night for all beings is the time of awakening for the self-controlled. And the time of awakening for all beings is night for the introspective sage. Can you follow this one? When everybody else is asleep, or what looks like night to them, and when they're looking around, they can't see a thing. It's darkness. But for the person who's this Sthita Dhimuni, that is daylight. He sees. And what's daylight to everybody else is night to him. In other words, let's think of a materialistic person who wants to enjoy the senses. They live in America, they like to go to places like Las Vegas. There are casinos and there are shows with chorus girls without much clothes on. And people are eating meat all the time and drinking and gambling. And when they see that, their eyes get big. And it's what they want. But somebody who's actually a Sthiti Muni, when he goes there, he says, there's nothing here. It's night. Not interested. And similarly, if one of those persons who likes to enjoy like that comes here in the Krishna temple, what's he going to say? Well, there's nothing happening here. Nothing going on. I remember once explaining to somebody, he asked about our regulations, and I told him, well, we don't eat meat, fish, or eggs. We don't take any intoxicants. We don't have illicit sex, and we don't gamble. And he looked like this. He says, what do you do? That sort of exhausted the options as far as he was concerned. So these are two kinds of people. Prabhupada explains this. There are two classes of intelligent persons. Notice how he uses this word intelligent. This is buddhi that he's talking about. There are two classes of intelligent persons. One is intelligent in material activities for sense gratification. You see, the whole direction of the mind is going in that way. It's the buddhi that makes all the thinking, feeling, and willing simply in terms of sense gratification. So one is intelligent in material activities for sense gratification, and the other is introspective, he looks inside, and awake to the cultivation of self-realization. Activities of the introspective sage, the thoughtful person, are night for persons materially absorbed. So this is the two kinds of things. The first piece of Krishna conscious literature I ever read was a essay by Prabhupada called Who is Crazy? And it was actually a class given on this verse. They were passing them out at the street. And the first thing I picked up, it said, who is crazy? Okay, I was just looking at these devotees jumping up and down, and I thought, God, they're crazy. I'll never do anything like that. And they give a piece of literature that says, who is crazy? As it turned out, I was. Huh? So then he continues, a person, this is a very nice, important verse, a person who's not disturbed by the incessant flow of desires that enter like rivers into the ocean, which is ever being filled but is always still, can alone achieve peace, and not the man who strives to satisfy such desires. So a couple of interesting features about this verse. So even if I am steady in this path, still desires may flow in. Maybe as long as we're in the material bodies, desires will come, at least sometimes. But they don't disturb. They let them go by. And it says here this person is compared to the ocean. Huge volumes of water are pouring in everywhere, and the ocean remains, because it's so big, it's not doesn't rise and fall with the rivers. It's just this the same. So like that, desires may come in, but the ocean remains still. That person who's not disturbed can alone achieve peace, and not the one who strives to satisfy such desires. This is the kind of opposite course from which the whole world is on. Now you see this difference between night and day. They are looking for happiness by satisfying the desires. We are looking for happiness by trying to become free from them. It's two ways to go. Which way you go, that determination of the course of life in the long run on this basis, that is the intelligence which points us one way or the other. So this Buddha Yoga is the cultivation of this, what's actually the real function of intelligence, to point us toward transcendence. A person who has given up all desires for sense gratification, who lives free from desires, who has given up all sense of proprietorship, and is devoid of false ego, he alone can attain real peace. That is the way of the spiritual and godly life, after attaining which a man is not bewildered. If one is thus situated, even at the hour of death, one can enter the kingdom of God. That's the end of the chapter. So there's the description of this kind of cultural hero for the spiritualist, this sage of steady mind, Sthitadi Muni, and all different aspects have been described, and also why such a person wants to act like this. So it's nice to look at these verses, and I think they're inspiring. I always return to them occasionally just to get the picture of what one is supposed to be like. And Krishna puts it in there to inspire and to encourage Arjuna. Okay, I want to stop now. Any questions? We have a little thing to talk to everybody about. So we'll end the class, and then Mother Dina Sharna and I want to talk to you about a certain situation in our German yatra. He's already heard it. No, we just said, if we put this into a play with our current issues, we put this into effect, everything will be fine. At that fixed intelligence. So, any questions about this topic here? Yeah.
If thinking, feeling, and willing are functions of the mind, generally one might think that thinking is the function of intelligence. And what is the function of intelligence?
The function of intelligence in the reason of thinking. What do I think about? Anytime I think, my thinking is based on presuppositions. Things that I assume from the beginning, things that I take for granted. When I think, I use words and ideas. Those words and ideas are already coming to me in a packaged way. So the whole, all thinking takes place within a framework, a Weltanschauung. And as you know, there are many Weltanschauungen. How do you choose between them when you have to live inside of one or inside another? It is intelligence which determines this whole context of thinking and feeling and willing. It is intelligence, for example, when I go into a room, what do I notice and what do I not notice? What attracts my attention? What doesn't attract my attention? In fact, there's so much happening just in the room. What do I see and what do I not see? Immediately, the sense of the choice is made even before I can think about it. That's also intelligence, which does that. One function of intelligence is it helps the senses, it allows us to identify objects. What does it mean to recognize something or identify something? It means there's a whole framework together with memory by which something is considered to belong to a certain category, to be a thing of a certain type. All this is by intelligence. So intelligence determines the whole mental set, a frame of mind within which we work. Most people never even question that mindset. They take it in with their mother's milk and they live in it all their lives. And the significant choice you make, here's one. When there are two kinds of intelligent persons, one for sense gratification and one for self-realization, right? Those are two whole ways of looking at the world, based on your conviction or maybe your faith. How will I become happy? The whole material world is mostly convinced that they'll become happy by gratifying their senses. But here's another whole way of looking at the world, where the senses are the sense gratification is the cause of suffering. Which one is it? So these are two whole outlooks. So to choose between these two is really the function of intelligence. That's why this Buddhi Yoga, this Bhagavad Gita, is actually for the cultivation or the culture of intelligence. Because when intelligence is purified and fully developed, it turns out to be that which connects us to the super soul. Intelligence ultimately, in its highest function, it's always acting this way, but we perceive the super soul by the actions of intelligence. Otherwise, according to the description in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is in the heart as the super soul. When we want to remember Krishna, he gives us the intelligence to remember. When we want to forget, it gives us the intelligence to forget. We actually, that intelligence is being directed ultimately by the super soul, either to go toward Krishna, or if we want to go away from Krishna, he directs our mind in this way. You want to get away from me? So here now I'll give you what you want. I'll give you so many inspiring arguments that there is no God. Prabhupada asked this question. There are so many arguments. God is dead. There is no God. Everything happens by accident. He said, where do these arguments come from? He said, they come from Krishna. He inspires them from inside. They go in that direction. So this is how intelligence works. So actually, even this Buddha Yoga, we turn toward Krishna, but to actually act in a strong way requires Krishna's help. What's in our power is to turn one way or another and show whatever determination we have. So this is how it works. It's a long topic. Because most of us, the highest our materialistic culture goes is the mind, the mental platform. The culture of the mind happens in universities and colleges. The thinkers are there, and they take different ideas, and they entertain themselves with it. They accept them for a while, then they reject them and take up another idea or another theory, and they play with this theory, and then they discard that theory and take another theory, and so on, one thing after another. This is the mental platform. But then the culture of intelligence, that's Bhagavad Gita. And then the highest culture, the culture of the soul, that is Srimad Bhagavatam. So these are levels of culture. The culture of the body, culture of the mind, culture of the intelligence, and culture of the soul proper. This is Prabhupada's description. Okay? Let's go, huh? Yeah?
Sorry.
Uh-huh.
One is the best?
Yeah.
The other one is the smaller.
Okay.
Is there something about pure intelligence?
Hmm?
You were talking about pure intelligence. So when the intelligence is pure, does it mean that this intelligence in every different person will be the same? Because if it's pure, it has one particular quality.
Yeah, that's right. But
depending on where it is, it's the same?
It's the same in the fact that it's receiving or giving us directions from Krishna. In a general way, the directions will be the same to act in Krishna's service. The specific way we act will depend on the individual in the service to Krishna. So it's not that we're all stamped out of like a cookie cutter. Okay? So let me tell you a little bit, if I can have your attention, about our situation in Germany. Myself, I'm the GBC for Germany, representing the international GBC body. We also have a European, just for Europe, a subcommittee of this GBC, and Dina Sharna is the GBC that reports to that body. So together we are the GBCs for Germany. Now, we've just finished a meeting with the German Nationalrat, their council, opposed of all the temple presidents, to this, deal with this issue. And this is the beginning of a 2-year marathon effort. A kind of a 2-year, something of a state of emergency for us. And this is the emergency over the last 3 or 4 years, we have all been trying to deal in a piece by piece or fashion with a problem we have inherited from the past. Most people here now in Germany were not involved in this. They're not guilty of anything. But at the same time, now if we are ISKCON, this is ISKCON's problem. It's a long story about how these problems arose. It has a financial aspect, some debts from the past. It has to do with a big project where near Wiesbaden, a building called Hohenstein was purchased back in the early 90s, I guess, mid-90s, early part of the 90s, was purchased to make a huge temple and center. The devotees who, this was purchased for ISKCON, but devotees took out the mortgages in their own names. Then the project failed. The building is still sitting there, unoccupied, and two-thirds finished. And devotees have been still trying to pay at least the interest. What is interest in German there? The interest on the on the mortgage, just to keep from. So they're running out of effort. The mortgage is about 300,000 euros, and they have been paying on it. This Hohenstein is actually the legal owner, is an ISKCON property holding company in Liechtenstein called Business Invest. That same company owns this building. And the farm, Jandelsburg, Simachala, and Golokadam, Abenteuer. All these properties are owned by the same a property holding company. Now, devotees are the directors of that company, which is in Liechtenstein, but there's a fiduciary agent, a verwalter, who has a lot of power. If people stop making the payments, the bank on these mortgages, the bank goes to their Business Invest and said, where's our money? Business Invest has no money, but it has properties. And Des Verwalter has the right of his own free will to decide, well, I'll sell the Cologne Temple, or I'll sell, he can then liquidate the other assets, sell them and turn them into money to pay this mortgage. So in this way, we have to deal with this problem. So that's one problem. There's a whole group, and many other people at the time this project was started, aside from the people that are paying the mortgages, there were other people who gave loans, and they've never been repaid for the same project. So that's one of the things. And also from the past, there were a number of people who gave donations to the movement, large donations. And now it would seem that they have a good chance, if they want, to go to court and say that donation was taken from me in a wrong way. I was somehow coerced or pressured or deluded or something, taken advantage of to give this big sum of money, and it may seem that the courts will agree with them. So this is our issue. I will tell you that the whole sum total comes to close to 1 million euros. And but we are not distressed. Because Dina Sharna has sat and got some inspiration for working on this problem, and the main thing is that the first choice we had to make, because the problem looked so overwhelming to people that many of our leaders just wanted to forget about it. We are not responsible. We'll go on preaching Krishna consciousness. If they stop making the payments, if these other people go to court, let what will happen, and we'll just see what Krishna does. That's the one attitude. We cannot be all the time burdened with this stuff from the past. We didn't do it. It's stopping us from preaching Krishna consciousness. Let's just let the whole thing just collapse and see what happens. The other attitude is whatever, however it is, it is our responsibility. We can't just let things collapse. We don't know what will happen. Although we have this outlasten from on the one hand, we've also received from the past this temple, the farm, Abenteuer, a society of devotees, so it's not all bad. You take the good, you can get. Sometimes you have to take both together. And so, now we have a process for dealing with this, and we have given this process to the National Council, and they have all gotten on board. They have all accepted it, and are ready to help. And the first part of the process, as we were worried about this for 3 or 4 years, it was only a tiny group of people who were trying to deal with this problem, not very successfully. So the first stage is that we take this to all the German Yatra. And in fact, beyond the German Yatra, we let everybody know what our situation is and about how we are putting our commitment to do something about it into action. The financial problem also has a lot of emotional baggage attached to it. This big debt happened, and people are saying, who did it? Who's responsible? How did it happen? There's also a big debt to the BBT as part of that. Where did the books go? The books disappeared, and the money didn't come in. Who took the books? There are many people who feel abused, hurt, wounded in this process. So there's a whole emotional and social and personal part of this. But we are separating them. Dina Sharma came up with this idea, let's separate these two things. Here's the financial, which we have to deal with now. And the other thing will be the personal and emotional, which we will also deal with, but the financial thing we have to, whatever, just we're dealing with the money, let's just accept it and take care of it. So this has been our process. One, to bring this to the public and see if we have support. At the Sankirtan festival in the farm, Dina Sharma and I spoke to all the people about this problem, and immediately somebody, not us, was inspired to say, we should give money right away, and they passed around a basket, and we got about 1,500 euros without our even asking. So we can see right away that actually everybody wants to help in some way or another. And so that was the other thing, bring it to the public. We separated the problems out. We are also embarking on a course of action to do some planning and reorganization in the German Yatra, so something like this will not happen again. So that leaders become all accountable, and that there are processes in place so that people don't contract debts and go off on projects that are not fully examined by other people. You want to tell a little bit about this? And give it a sort of outline.
Yeah, anyway, like Varela said, at the beginning this problem was so entangled that nobody could really find an answer to this. But by making the separation, it became very clear that even though it is very important to take care of the hurts of the people and all their disappointments, but still this process takes a long time. And we want to have an office where these things can be dealt with, people, we can talk to them, we can help them with different things, even to the point of if we needed to go to professional therapy if necessary. But what is important is also that the monastic vision cannot wait until all of these critical